It is my great pleasure to introduce Peter Walsh, our guest speaker today. Of course, for most of you, Peter needs no introduction. He's here at church most Sundays, often up front as a regular member of the choir. It's been many years since we've heard Peter share his poetry with the congregation, and you are in for a real treat today.
Be asked to read some of my poetry to you this morning, and grateful to you for being here to listen to it. Reading poems in public for me is a daunting, even terrifying experience, since it reveals so much about the inner life of the poet. So what are poems anyway, and why write them? The answers to these questions are complex and must be different for every poet. For me, the poems are windows of at least two different kinds. One as a window allowing the reader to see deeply into the soul of the poet. The other is a window allowing the poet and the reader to see deeply into the moment that is the poem, and so to preserve it in time as an historical record. Part of the answer to why I write poems is my love of language, my fascination with the sound and origin of words, and my compulsion to experience the world in metaphorical terms. I'm a scientist and physician, and have spent my life and career posing questions and seeking answers to them, in part by stating the questions as metaphors. The poems that I will read this morning are a retrospective of those written over the past 30 years. The first poem I will read is entitled Imps. Originating from Germanic folklore, the imp is a small, lesser goblin, often mischievous rather than evil or harmful, much the same as fairies who play tricks or pranks on people. However, this is really a poem about writer's block. Poems come from a mysterious place in the mind. They are always welcome, but no matter how hard I try, I cannot beckon the poem. I must wait for the poem to choose me. This poem was written recently after a 6-month dry spell. It is entitled Imps. Lately, the imps have been playing tricks on me, stealing every kernel of wordplay that might sprout into a poem. And they have been hiding in the corners of my mind, devouring every trope and playing tag with me in a game where I am always it, but have to give it up to the imps who gobble it up and giggle lasciviously and tickle my ribs to teach me the law of evanescence that governs each one of us in the end. I've always been fascinated by cosmology and quantum mechanics. I read about these topics as much as I can, but I must confess that my understanding of them is limited by my very limited knowledge of higher mathematics, which is the basis of all our concepts on the structure of the universe and subatomic matter. So I turned to poetry to express my wonder. The last line in the poem is attributed to my friend, Tom Schoonmaker. This poem is entitled Dark Matter. The dreams have been more frequent lately, the quiet sobbing in the night, the crying out in pain that occupies the dark matter that comes with sleep. There is dark matter of a different sort. Well, maybe not so different, that cosmologists tell us makes up 22% of the universe, with 74% being dark energy. That leaves only 4%, only one part in 25, that is the stuff we can see or hear or touch or taste or smell, like the breast that feeds us or a distant star. Great Caesar's ghost, the Ides of March, has crept up on me unnoticed again. And the clouds gather in a conclave on the horizon, plotting our demise. There is still so much I don't understand at this late stage about dark matter, the glue that holds us together like sexual attraction, and dark energy that drives us apart like a spinning top. It's that mystery that makes me smile, that keeps me boggled to know that life is good, to listen to the man when he says, do not be a grumpy old man. It's not gin. If the last poem was about cosmology, the next one is about quantum mechanics, the theory that governs the structure of subatomic particles. It is entitled Home. Randomness is the enemy of order, saith the physicists, and yet quantum particles can be here and there at the same time, taking random walks in space to make order out of chaos. Just yesterday, all was gray, and yet tonight, the thin sliver of the new moon smile against the electric blue of dusk has grown into a wide grin as the incandescence of daffodils shines against the black earth. See how the forsythia trembles in ecstasy each time a bird shuttles from the feeder in a shudder of quantum weirdness, making me glad that of all the possible universe, this is my chosen home. The next poem is dedicated to my friends Tom Schoonmaker, Al Ehrlich, Mark Kofke, Bob Brown, and Mel Strebe. Since it is with them that I experienced the events described in the first half of the poem, set in the woods on a mountain in northern Vermont, where we hiked together in September 2003. In the second half, the poem morphs into a series of questions posed by the Aboriginal people of Australia. The poem is entitled Shadows. There is a curious way the fog takes the third dimension from the images of trees in this dense wood and the echo from the hollow knocking of the pileated woodpecker. It's like seeing the early morning with one eye closed, as if the chortling of a small animal or bird is soaked in silence, and mystery seeps from the scrim of mist. This stand of maple and spruce silhouettes the white paper of young birches, where many years ago there stood a beaver pond, until the loggers blew their dam to smithereens. The beavers had a choice, to take hot lead into their brains or move way up the valley into the mountain to take up new residence upon the earth. And then, as the fog burns off, the chiaroscuro of trees goes back into the fire of the sun and reappears as shadows, like the memory of dreams that leave only unanswered questions. If you are white and I am black, then why are both our shadows black? Where do shadows go when the sun goes down, before the rising of the moon? Are they lost in the dark? Do they go back into our bodies? Or do they jump behind the clouds with the sun? if the shadow falls into clear water, is the soul in danger of drowning? Is the shadow cast by the sun the same or different from the shadow cast by the moon? Be careful how you answer, lest you be trapped in the shadow of an idea or the idea of a shadow. Here is another poem about fog. It was written when we lived on Horder Street in Westmount area, around the corner from this church. It is actually a series of 9 numbered poems, 4 of which are examples of the short Japanese poetic form referred to as haiku. Haiku traditionally evoke images of the natural world and are characterized by 3 lines, the first and third of which have 5 syllables, and the second of which contains 7 syllables. The poem is entitled Fog After Snow Between Christmas and the New Year, What the Fog Taught. 1. Now the wolf moon screws down her leering light upon the snowscape in the lap of night, and then the fog, with some obscurity of sound, settles with a sigh upon the breathing ground. It brings to focus, like a lens of sintered smoke, all the fine dark branchings of the sleeping oak. It turns the technicolor city into shades of gray, compresses space, and keeps the world at bay. 2. Single, silent crow, black wings palpating the air, swims across the scrim. 3. My German shepherd walks with me through timeless space, sniffing mist for news. 4. Man with camera trying to capture the awe of our fading forms. 5. Men, a 1,000-pound combination safe on wheels, stays in shadows underneath the cellar stairs these last 12 years since we moved in. I still do not have the combination. Every day I learn a little more about living with uncertainty, sleeping with ambiguity, walking in fog. 6. Clothed in the smoky, bone-cold coat that seeps and simmers through the city streets, like a prowling thief or a mood of doom, I listen to the whispers of the city, muffled like lovers overheard behind a cedar door. 7. I come in and shudder off the fog, in the cozy incandescence of the kitchen, to slice the pungency of oranges and lemons. I always thought that making marmalade was something that only mothers do on snow days in the fog. 8. Midnight tolls the bell. As mist simmers up from earth, someone eats 12 grapes. 9. How often now I turn back to those noble oaks who teach us by their attitudes and stature how to pray with arms upstretched to touch the jaundiced face of winter, and how they cluster close to me in fog as we listen for something in the fog, something deep within the fog. The next poem I will read is entitled Ode to Ignorance. It was inspired by an essay I once read by an author whose name I have forgotten in praise of ignorance. The poem makes reference to 2 poems I greatly admire by Jared Manley Hopkins, the great 19th century poet and Anglican priest. The 2 poems referred to here are The Windover and Pied Beauty, two of my favorite poems, which I wish I had time to read to you. Here is a poor substitute, Ode to Ignorance. I yearn for reverence so I could write The Windover, dream on, the finest crafted of all poems. Instead, I am blessed with ignorance, which makes the bear fish in summer and sleep all winter. I am more bear than priest, searching for berries, each one a meager feast, a mere morsel of truth. Curiosity killed the cat, even the one with nine lives, looking for who knows what out of ignorance, not bliss. Take my neighbor's cat called Bentley, a Burmese, I think, who stuck his curious nose into any stranger's face, including Gilead, the dog next door, who was adept at killing groundhogs, raccoons, possums, squirrels. This was a dangerous place to be, but somehow he got away with it so far. Somehow, so far, so have I. Without ignorance, I fear there can be no curiosity. Without curiosity, I swear there can be no questions. Without questions, there are no answers. Without answers, there is no knowledge. No knowledge, naught but ignorance. No ignorance, no truth. No truth, no beauty. So I sing my song in praise of ignorance, the next best thing to pied beauty. Nearly 30 years ago, Marnie and I made a trip to Japan for a scientific meeting and to spend some time getting to know Japan. The following poem consists of five haiku depicting the trip out and the trip back, and the feelings of being there. It is entitled Orientation. Flying west compressed the seething dawn and drew the long, thin day to gold. Rising sun was one with ashen moon, fusing blue yin with crimson yang. Dying swan upon the placid view, saw mountains in the morning dew. Steaming tea can be a sprout like bamboo, greening in the heart of me. Squeezing light from night paints two dawns on the pallid face of homeward flight. In addition to the 1st of January, another new year we celebrate occurs in the days preceding Rosh Hashanah, a time of introspection and repentance, and the subsequent Jewish festival of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. These are the Jewish high holy days, which are some of the most meaningful and spiritual to me of our religious calendar, in part because, as a member of the choir, I am able to participate in the performance of the beautiful Hebrew music that characterizes these holidays. It is during these holidays, on September 10th, 2001, that I was inspired to write the following poem entitled Atonement. There comes a time in this man's waning life when quiet desperation dark descends and every fiber of him wants to make amends for all transgressions still creating strife. We are the only species here on earth who know we live and have to die, and spend our lives inventing demons to defy while keeping up our strange capacity for mirth. Solar flares are crashing on the shore of rocky discord as we dig the earth and sift through shards of broken psyches, rent and rift by infidelities eroding to the core. All this chaos came in humankind to be, along with consciousness that came with fire and its cousin conscience following desire to fill the void of loneliness with rhapsody. A picture painted is an image disassembled. Even procreation creates imperfection, since each one of us is faulty at conception. A poem parsed is merely truth dissembled. But if we knew we're flawed, we would be freed from seeking consummation of our greed. Instead, we would forgive ourselves and find atonement, true surcease, and peace of mind. I'm going to read a poem entitled The Clown, which was inspired by two people to whom the poem is dedicated. One is the Reverend Matthew McNaught, who served as interim minister of USG before Kent Mathias became our minister. Reverend McNaught preached a sermon about the importance of levity, humor, and clowning for religion that intrigued me. The other person who inspired this poem was my longtime friend and colleague, Dr. David Mills, a brilliant English scientist with an unconventional sense of humor and a rebellious nature, whose family created the Cyril Bertrand Mills Circus, the British equivalent of the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus in the United States. So he was not a stranger to the art of clowning. David's voice is heard intermittently throughout this poem, The Clown. He sidles over to me on a sun-drenched noon, obliquely and with an indirectness of purpose, as if to say, "Don't be so serious about all this. I only want to make you laugh and cry in the same exhalation." He beseeches me with his huge incarnadine lips, the color of living flesh, and rouged cheeks bleeding with pathos into his dead white face. "Take it upon yourself to don my outsized shoes, silly suit, and apple red nose, and play the only one able to poke fun at the king and keep his head." His deep set, darkly circled eyes mime his story. "As soon as I was born, I slipped into my harlequin skin, like a fool riding backwards on an ox or an ass, or a coyote playing the trickster." He entangles me with daydreams, embellished with grace, holding up his magic mirror so I can see myself saying, "Verily, I say unto you, except as you become a holy fool, you shall not enter the kingdom of life."
Isn't it rich? Aren't we a Sandy. just when I stopped opening doors, finally knowing the one that I wanted was yours, making my entrance again with my usual flair, sure of my lines, no But where are the clowns? Quick, send in the clowns. Don't bother, they're here. Isn't it rich? Isn't it queer? Losing my timing this
Give us this day the aroma of grace, the scent of crushed basil and boxwood in the wet garden, the song of the joyous bird awakening at dawn and hungry for life, the heard notes not heard by ordinary ears, the pealing of light from the dark sky. Let us walk through the valley of the healing waters and hear the drumbeats of our hearts parsing the language of love in the jungle of hate, only to squeeze in the fist the oil and water and salt and fire, only what is true, only this poem, this day.